day, ladies and gentlemen. Nice to talk to you today. I'm Henrik Palmgren, and this is Red Eyes Radio. I hope you had a good weekend with lots of fun and managed to learn something new about our world and our history. The truth is both exciting and challenging. That's just how it goes. So, we've been doing this series on the secret space program and breakaway civilization. And we want to give you a flavor of the upcoming conference in San Mateo in California, June 28th and 29th. I'll be hosting that particular event, and Red Eyes are not organizing the conference. I'm just the host, so there's not a executive decision-making from my part on this one. So we ask you to check all the details, the speakers, schedule, and tickets at secretspaceprogram.org. On our website, redeyescreations.com, you can find all our previous programs, a busy news section, videos, links, and many other resources. On our members' website, redeyesmembers.com, you have our full archives with shows going back to 2006 on all kinds of topics, down to earth and off the wall. We cast a wide net, and we investigate and highlight a lot of different topics. You might not like everything we cover, but we do try to make it interesting, and we offer you a lot of different opinions to think about. Michael Schrett is a private pilot, a military aerospace historian who has lectured across the U.S. on the unique subject of mystery aircrafts and classified propulsion systems buried deep within the military-industrial complex. Today, we are going to talk about that military-industrial complex, specifically the American aerospace industry, who has designed, built, and test-flown saucer-shaped aircraft which mimic the form, fit, and function of what people perceive to be extraterrestrial UFOs, unidentified flying objects. The black budget and off-black budget is a huge part of this, and we'll try to get closer to who is running the program and for what reason. Hi, Michael. Welcome. Thank you for coming on Red Eyes Radio. Good to talk to you today. Hope you're doing well.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Great. Glad to be a part of it.
Great. Great. Now, before we get into some of the main topics here, we're going to discuss, of course, as a way of introducing you a little bit more, tell us about the work you've been doing in the last few, I don't know how long you've been involved. You've been a private pilot, a military aerospace historian, of course, but what dragged you into this particular topic, Michael?
I've just been very fascinated by unusual aircraft. I'm a concerned citizen and a concerned taxpayer. I want to find out where my tax dollars are disappearing, and that's really been my angle. And what I've tried to do is I've tried to focus in on engineers, pilots, people who have security clearances, specifically Lockheed Skunk Works engineers who worked under Ben Rich between 1975 and 1991. Those, I personally believe, are the closest to the truth that we're going to get, and so that's what I've really focused in on.
Definitely. I mean, it's a huge subject, this overall, of just trying to figure out man-made versus the whole ET issue and everything else. As you've been researching this over the years now, though, have you gotten closer at all to this question? Maybe you had a stance from the beginning that a lot of what we are looking at actually indeed is man-made.
I have gotten closer, and I definitely want to go over some specific details of why I think that.
Let's do that right away and talk a little bit more about this whole issue. What do you think, when people report UFOs, et cetera, it seems like a lot of people have a tendency to believe that, okay, people think it's alien, it has to be an extraterrestrial issue, everything. What people, despite though, forget is, of course, that UFO has nothing to do, per se, with the alien. It has just something to do with an unidentified flying aircraft. And the fact is, this could be anything from our own creation to advanced kind of, aircraft and everything else. It might just be something that we see. But how did you approach this subject of trying to sort this out, Michael?
Well, what I'd like to do is I'd like to lay some groundwork here and provide a foundation. Since this is a secret space program conference, I think that the most important thing we can do is to prove the existence of the black budget first, which can then support the existence of a secret space program and the craft that are associated with that. So what I'd like to do is I want to jump into an article that was published years ago. It's a very interesting article. This is February 8th of 1987, Detroit Free Press. And here it says, Secret Ledger Hides Military Projects. And then there's a subtitle, Pentagon Black Budget Has Tripled Under the Reagan Administration. So that's the title of the article. Now, within this article, they talk about procurement funding for the black budget. And they state that at the beginning of the Reagan administration in 1981, the black budget grew just over $500 million. So that's a key figure to keep in mind. By the end of the Reagan administration, near the end of 88, the black budget grew by over $9.122 billion. Federal spending procurement funding for the Pentagon's black budget was $35 billion, and then the total procurement Air Force funding for fiscal year 1988 was $51 billion. Of that, the Air Force black budget was $19.1 billion. So the question we need to ask is, how much of those black budget funds went to conventionally powered military aerospace vehicles, and then how much of that funding was trickled off and funneled into the secret space program aircraft? Those are the ones that we want to discuss. So that's kind of the number one question that I want to address. And then two really quick quotes that I want to discuss here. I'm just going to read this. We don't have time to do it all, but just want to read you two really quick quotes. This is within the article. It says, Thomas Amley, a Pentagon missile expert with security clearances high enough to know about some black programs, said the military has three basic reasons for having them. He's talking about black programs. One, you're doing something that should genuinely be secret. There's only a couple of those, and stealth ain't one of them, it says. And then he says, two, you're doing something so damn stupid you don't want anyone to know about it. And then three, it says, you want to rip money back open and get out a shovel because there is no accountability whatsoever. So you can see the mindset of what these people who are working in black programs are actually thinking. And then the last one here, it says, this is a 31-year-old expert. In a black project, people don't worry about money, said a 31-year-old systems engineer who has worked on four black projects at the Space Systems Division of Lockheed Missiles and Space Company in Sunnyvale, California. He says, quote, if you need money, you got it. If you screw up and you need more, you got it, said the engineer who asked that his name not be published. He says, quote, you're just pouring money into the thing until you get it right. The incentive isn't there to do it right the first time. Who's going to question it? So here you can see when you have these black budgets, anything goes. According to this engineer, if you screw up, that money is just swept under the carpet, and it's just an empty check. And so my concern is, and this is something that every concerned American taxpayer should really look into, is how much of these funds are possibly being funneled into aerospace vehicles that are associated with the secret space program.
Well, exactly. The question as well is, of course, is it just a government program run really poorly, or is it perhaps a slush fund? I mean, I know that you talk about not only black programs, but also deep black programs, things that go even underneath of what we think is the official budget for things. So there's a multi-tiered layer to this, of course, but it's also this very idea that, you know, are they getting what they presumably are paying for? That's the other question to all of this.
Correct. I mean, there's no telling how many of these programs were started, canceled, and then completely forgotten about, and there's no congressional oversight, there's no public scrutiny, and there's no historical account. We'll never know about it. It could be countless trillions of dollars have been poured into these. Just a quick point. The A-12 Avenger II, which was a General Dynamics McDonnell Douglas program to replace the A-6 Intruder, this has now been taken over by Lockheed because they bought the General Dynamics division, their aerospace division. So Lockheed is the point of contact on this. So in 1986, this was such a deep black program that engineers who worked on the program were forbidden to even bring in a bag of Doritos out of fear that other employees might figure out the configuration of the aircraft. That's just how black this program was. And then by 1991, Dick Cheney canceled the program at the cost of $5 billion to taxpayers. So being a concerned taxpayer, I contacted the public affairs office at Lockheed Fort Worth, and I told them, you know, I have no hidden agenda here. I'm a concerned taxpayer. I'd like to see my portion of the $5 billion. May I please have a washer from the program? Because according to C-SPAN, over $3 million of material actually, 3 million pounds of material were cut on the A-12 Avenger 2 program. And I thought, well, they can at least give me a washer for my $5 billion worth. They won't even do that. So you can see just how deep black these programs are.
Well, exactly. Interesting point. Now, there are, of course, a number of different crafts that we perhaps can discuss a little bit later. Some have been, you know, successes. Some have crashed. Eyewitness testimony to some of these, etc. But what can we assume, do you think, that they actually have today? Again, if we just talk about the success rate of what they've managed to produce, do you think that they've come close to something that they actually wanted? Should we assume that they actually have managed to produce something which we today perceive as being basically a, you know, UFO technology?
Absolutely. Let me give you three examples. First of all, we want to discuss the Hudson Valley boomerang. This was between 1982 and 1989, over 25,000 eyewitnesses in the Hudson Valley area. This is approximately 25 minutes north of downtown New York City. What they reported seeing, in a nutshell, is a gigantic flying wing configuration, a boomerang-type configuration with a single triangle trailing edge, and this is between 82 and 89. Sightings were ongoing until 1995. But what's interesting to report is that on March 24th of 1984, hundreds of people pulled off to the side of the road on the Taconic Freeway, and when they looked up, they saw a 300-foot-wide boomerang-shaped craft that had a single triangle trailing edge. But then the eyewitnesses reported that when they looked up on the bottom surface of the craft, they could see what looked like transparent panels, so you could see the interior structure of the vehicle. And they said that it looked like a steel structural crossbeam and girder construction, like a truss bridge. So the question I'm asking is, does that sound like something extraterrestrial to you? Something that has crossbeam girder construction, steel structural construction. A number of these sightings took place on Thursday nights, and if anyone researches black programs, you'll notice that many, if not all, the test flights of black aircraft between the early 1980s and the late 1990s always occurred on Thursday nights. And why is that? Because Mondays, Tuesdays, and Wednesdays are reserved for pre-flight. Thursday is the test, and Friday is the debrief. And so this matches up with what we hear from the eyewitness reports.
Interesting point. Now, what do you think that they actually are using these aircrafts for? Is this taking place in military programs and operations around the world, unbeknownst to maybe even the official military targets, if you will, or is it for something completely different?
Well, I'm going to go out on a limb here, and I want to credit my friend Joseph Jones, who alerted me to this. So this was March 24th, 1984, where this took place. Now, a day earlier, it was the 23rd March of 1984, Ronald Reagan gave his address to the nation talking about the SDI, Strategic Defense Initiative, or the Star Wars program. So isn't it funny that, is it just a coincidence that 24 hours after he gave this lecture, we have these huge boomerang sightings north of New York City. So what Joseph believes these are is these are a defensive weapon system where they can set up an electromagnetic umbrella encompassing American cities, making them impervious to incoming Russian ICBM attacks. That's what he believes. I tend to support it because the timing is just too coincidental. I don't think it's a coincidence. Now, we should also mention something that also occurred just a few months later on July 24th of 1984. An even more inspiring encounter took place. This is over the Indian Point nuclear reactor. There was a 35-knot wind. This took place at night, where no less than 12 security guards witnessed a gigantic, now they said it was approximately 900 feet across. This is a gigantic craft. Boomerang-shaped craft that hovered over the reactor for 30 minutes despite a 35-knot wind. It shut down the security system, but there was one security guard that had a visual on this with a video camera, and he videotaped this whole event, and he said that this craft was, quote, so large that he had to pan the camera 180 degrees to get the whole craft in the frame field of view. So that's how gigantic this craft was, and I definitely believe that this is one of ours.
Interesting. How do we, we've talked with plenty of other people as well that suggest, you know, that they have various crafts have been developed, they're experimenting and everything else, but there seemed to be another interesting factor to it, which is that kind of suggests that they're actually flying over residential areas. There's almost an idea that they were trying and attempting to show them off, for the lack of a better term, in some regards. Is it, I mean, is this used to perpetuate the UFO myth of things, or is there any other reason for this, do you think?
I only want to go by the facts of what the eyewitnesses report. Now, they reported, if you look at the structure of the vehicle, they reported that the bottom of the craft had flashing multicolored lights, but then they also stated that the bottom texture of the craft looked like it had tubes, pipes, and cylinders sticking out of it. So, to me, that doesn't sound like an extraterrestrial craft. So we have to keep in mind, tubes, pipes, and cylinders. Other eyewitnesses reported that it looked like a, quote, inverted Midas muffler shop with these silencers and tubes sticking out of it. And so that's important to keep in mind. The same type bottom understructure was reported in the 1989 and 1990 Belgium triangle sightings, where this gigantic 300 feet per side triangular-shaped craft hovered over there, and then two F-16s were scrambled in 1990. They got it on their radar system. That also had the same bottom structure as well. So we can see this pattern repeating in multiple different craft.
And so my question again, are they showing this off? That's, I guess, what I was trying to get to. Are they?
Well, in one point, they're doing it because they can do it. They're doing it because they can do it.
Mm-hmm.
They are a rogue group, but they operate under their own parameters. Again, no congressional oversight, no public scrutiny. And the other fact is they're tested on Thursday nights. They have to test these things. Why they're testing it over a nuclear reactor, a nuclear power plant, that's out of my research area. But if you look at the eyewitness reports, if you look at what they're seeing within the structural details of the craft, personally, I believe it's a man-made craft.
Right. Yeah, I don't doubt that at all. Now, tell us a little bit more about some of the unclassified special access programs and everything else that has been going on throughout the years. I mean, a lot of them seems to have been developed, and they've either dropped them because, you know, they're starting to work on something else, or they've actually been a success and they've been, you know, applied in some methodology. They've said, okay, look, great, we got what we wanted. Either let's use it or let's mass produce it or whatnot. But how many do you think we're talking about in total? How many has been developed from like the 40s and up till today?
Well, I want to give you another example. January 5th, 2000, and many listeners may be familiar with this, there was a gigantic sighting of a what's known as the Southern Illinois Flying Triangle. It flew over multiple counties in Southern Illinois, including Highland, Lebanon, Summerfield, Shiloh, Millstead, and DuPont counties. This was also seen by multiple police officers, so it's absolutely 100% confirmed. What they reported seeing was a medium-sized two-story ranch house with multiple lights on the side of the vehicle. It looked like a square box with another level above it, so very unusual configuration. All right angles, nothing smooth contoured, nothing blown like a torch and then melted like wax, just right angle, so very bad for stealth configuration. But they also reported a triangular configuration with multiple red and green lights on the back end of the craft, with a white light on each terminating point of the triangle, and another larger white light on the bottom center of the vehicle, similar to what we saw in the Belgium triangle sightings. And then the other configuration, so we've got three different configurations. The other was a triangular-shaped craft with an arc on the back end similar to an arrowhead. So we can see a pattern recognition of the configurations of vehicles between this one and the Belgium triangle sighting. But one thing that is absolutely confirmed is that both craft, the Belgium craft and the Southern Illinois Flying Triangle, they had the capability of slow flight, but they also had the capability of hovering, and then when they departed like a spark off a grinding wheel with no sonic boom. That's something very consistent within these sightings. So Again, I don't think that this is an alien craft. I think this is one of ours.
Some seem to have crashed as well. Some test flights have actually gone pretty bad. How many of these do we have, do you think, that actually have gone down and they've been trying to, you know, retrieve them and get them back and fix whatever the issue was?
There are reports of crashes within the parameters of these vehicles, but when we specifically talk about the triangles, also the Southern Illinois Flying Triangle, I'm not aware of any crash retrievals of the Southern Illinois Flying Triangle type. So I guess I can't comment on that, but I do want to cover one more example of aircraft that may be associated with the secret space program. We're definitely not talking about conventionally jet-powered vehicles here. We are talking about the deepest of the black, the unacknowledged special access programs. These would have been programs that Kelly Johnson may have worked on, Ben Rich would have worked on, some things that McDonnell Douglas, when they were in business, which they were later taken over by Boeing, the Phantom Works Group. Those are the kind of programs we're talking about here. The other example is the Cash Landrum incident, December 29th, 1980, Huffman, Texas. In a nutshell, Vicki Landrum, Betty Cash, and Colby Landrum were driving on the road near Huffman, Texas at night around 9 p.m. A large double ice cream cone craft about 90 feet in height hovered about 150 feet in front of their car on the road. Was making a very high beeping noise. The craft emitted a blue flame, and every time it did, it bobbed up, and then it came down again. This went on for a bit. Betty Cash got a very good look of this vehicle outside of her vehicle. Keep in mind, this is in the winter of 1980, so it was cold outside. But when she got back in the car, they had to turn on the air because it was so hot. Bottom line is, as this departed, there were no less than 23 double-rotor Chinook CH-24 helicopters following this craft, and two of the primary eyewitnesses have since died of radiation sickness poisoning. The reason why I believe that this is a man-made craft and associated with the secret space program is because there's something called the NEPA program, the Nuclear Energy for Propulsion of Aircraft Program, but prior to 1960, it was called the ANP, Aircraft Nuclear Propulsion Program. So it pulled up the budgetary funding from the Congressional Subcommittee on Research and Development, and by 1960, between the U.S. Air Force, the United States Navy, and the Atomic Energy Commission, spent $990 million by 1960 on the ANP program, and I personally believe that some of that funding and test flying the aircraft that was associated with the Cash Landrum incident that Betty Cash and Vicki Landrum has since died on due to radiation sickness. So in point of fact, elements within the United States government are held liable for the murder of two eyewitnesses at this point.
Well, at least I'd say this is very interesting. So, what does that suggest if this is a man-made, that these people witnessed and that they were seeing, and at the same time you have a reaction from the U.S. military who scramble, you know, helicopters to go out there and check things out? It means that there's a disconnect. There's not a communication between the fact that this is known to the rest of the military. So, what does that suggest? Do you think in infighting? How do we explain that?
It suggests that we do have a black budget, we do have classified programs within that budget, and then above that we've got unacknowledged special access programs that perhaps the Atomic Energy Commission is working on, the United States Air Force, the United States Navy, of those, Lockheed's working on them, General Electric is probably working on a propulsion system associated with those, and then within those vehicles, those would be the type craft that are connected to the secret space program. That's the way I see the landscape as of right now.
So it wouldn't be safe to assume that it would be too volatile for them to test something like this when they potentially would get the regular military sent after them. They might even mean that there's something more interesting going on than that, perhaps, meaning that there actually isn't a connection at all with the military. Otherwise, they would just simply say, you know, stand down, this is all fine, we have this under control, etc. But that hasn't occurred in some of these situations anyway, as far as we know, right?
Interesting you mention that, because if you you know, I question, did General Norman Schwarzkopf know about these vehicles when they were fighting Desert Storm? I don't believe so. He didn't have a need to know. He didn't have a high enough security clearance. So there's definitely a breakaway military aerospace black world, which does kind of hint to the fact that there may be a breakaway civilization. But really, who is in charge here, and do our generals know about the toys we really have? I don't think they do. So in point of fact, you're correct. There is a breakaway here.
Yeah, exactly. I think that that's a very interesting point, because that would mean otherwise, obviously, they would utilize this technology, they would try to use it in warfare situations. Okay, certainly there has been some rumors and stories here and there, I think, of some kind of exotic weaponry used in certain combat situations, but nonetheless, it seems to have been very restricted. And I mean, on top of it, now we have official developments of drones, etc. But there's nothing that seems to suggest that they've gone so far to utilize the technology that you're talking about here.
Well, also keep in mind too that they're not going to roll out these toys for something. It's kind of bad to say it, but they're not going to roll out necessarily these type vehicles on just a war situation. These are reserved for something else. You know, that's why Lockheed could still build things for the F-16, because it's profitable for them to do that. Why would they want to produce craft that would make their own conventionally powered aircraft obsolete, losing billions in aerospace contracts? They can't do it. So these are reserved for something else.
Well, indeed. Now, what do you think about some of the developers here that we took, Lockheed, Northrop Grumman, Boeing, there's several others as well. Do you think that they are receiving the contracts from the rogue group within the government, and they're still doing their job? Or what is these, military defense companies' involvement in this, really?
I think you're right. I think it's the defense contractors within the aerospace military industrial complex, but I also think that the Office of Naval Research, the United States Navy, the Atomic Energy Commission, they're involved as well. So it's kind of a conglomerate of different organizations, but Lockheed would definitely be one of the prime contractors without any doubt at all.
But all this, though, just to reemphasize that point that you kind of began this on, which is very important, they are receiving taxpayer money as far as you're concerned.
They are receiving a portion of these black programs are paid for by American taxpayers. That is absolutely true. Now, within that group of aircraft, there's some aircraft that are over 40 years old that are now obsolete, have been replaced by new type aircraft systems which have come into the public domain. And so my effort is to get those aircraft declassified, the aircraft that represent no threat to the national security. If they were declassified, those are the ones that I go after and try to dislodge. And since we as taxpayers own those aircraft, at every right to question authority and make an attempt to get those aircraft declassified.
Right, right. So do you think that there could be any kind of level of profitability here with what has been developed, if they have indeed introduced that to the other, aircraft manufacturing market, what have you, so that they actually managed to some degree fund kind of their program and what they're doing? Any possibility of that?
Well, I mean, just think about what we've seen in the past. The B-2 stealth bomber, there's 21 built. Each one cost $2.3 billion per aircraft. That's more than its own weight in gold.
Wow.
So you know Northrop cashed in on that. Then you've got the F-22, which originally started out as a relatively affordable fighter, but then grew to well over $250 million. Now it's well over $300 million, approaching a half billion per aircraft. The F-35 Joint Strike Fighter has turned out to be a dog, has not fulfilled its mission. So, yes, the contractors are absolutely cashing in, no doubt about it at all.
Right.
I mean, can we really afford a fighter that's $350 million per copy? Can the American taxpayer afford that?
Yeah, I know.
I just don't know if we can do it anymore.
Yeah, I know.
Can we really afford it anymore?
Well, you guys should spend on where it's most important, obviously, back home at this stage when things are, infrastructure is falling apart, everything. I mean, you guys need the money internally within the country. And, again, who knows what the... Well, okay, let's speculate a little bit here then. let's assume that there are, you know, some other people have done this as well. I don't know if you go that far, but let's assume that there is some kind of real tangible threat out there, that this is a development within the rogue portion of the U.S. military because they have taken it upon themselves to actually try to understand and combat some kind of level of extraterrestrial threat. Is that any possibility? So that I'm not necessarily saying it's justified to do this without telling the people who are paying for it, of course, but nonetheless, is that a possibility, do you think?
Well, it's certainly a possibility, but the assessment that there may be an extraterrestrial threat, and that's why they're building, that's out of my research area, so I wouldn't comment on that. But just to go back on what you mentioned before, all we would need to do is not build one B-2 stealth bomber. We'd save $2.3 billion. And then how much of that funding could support bridge repair, could support schooling, could support housing? I mean, all we would need to do is just not build one, and we could do so much good. But see, when you're in a black world, and you've got contracts, and you've got multiple engineers, and you've got a blank check, you just keep throwing money at it, just like that engineer said. There's no accountability, and no one cares, because there's no incentive to do it right the first time. And so much fraud, waste, and abuse has gone on with these programs that taxpayers should be very concerned about how their money is being spent.
Exactly. Now, is there any way, do you think, to get closer to who actually sits? Because at the end of the day, someone is going to sit there and sign off on these budgets, right? They're going to approve it or say, you know, yay or nay. You know, so who is that, do you think?
Well, let me give you what I call the cover-up triad. This is what I believe. There's three people who know about black programs. They're very deep into it. And they most likely would know about the secret space program, aerospace vehicles as well. Number one, we have former President George Bush Sr. He was the head of CIA, so he would know. Number two, Dick Cheney. He would also know as well. We know the background of Dick Cheney, so that goes without saying. But there's another person that people may not know as well, but it's Bill Perry. The reason why Bill Perry would know is because, according to Frank Carlucci, when I interviewed Frank Carlucci, who's the head of the Carlyle Group, very well read into these programs, he said that the person to speak to about the black programs would be Bill Perry, because he, quote, cut the checks for Ben Rich at the Skunk Works, end quote. So it doesn't get any clearer than that. So these three gentlemen would know more than probably anyone else in the United States the level of blackness of these programs, and I would guess Bill Perry knows from beginning to end the whole legacy of stealth between 1980 and well up into the early 1990s. He would know from beginning to end, because he cut the checks to even get Have Blue started, which was the predecessor to the F-117A stealth fighter.
Interesting. Now, let's talk a little bit about what kind of propulsion potentially we're talking about. You, of course, mentioned some of the nuclear powered aspect to this. What do you think has been developed here? You know, there's talk about magnetic field disruptors. There's potentiality of straight out anti, gravity propulsion, etc. How far do you think they've come on this aspect?
Well, one other thing I want to kind of close out the last group of vehicles here is I interviewed a retired General Electric engineer about 10 years ago. I know his name. I won't mention it here, but he told me that in 1992 he was part of a program. This is according to this engineer. This is not me. He said that he was part of a program to tow a B-52 through an underground tunnel that connects Air Force Plant 42 to Edwards North Base Complex, about approximately 27 miles away as the bird flies. So you can think about it. This is an underground tunnel that's big enough to tow a B-52, so we're talking a huge bomber here, right? But then he said, as they were going through this tunnel, and incidentally, the B-52 had a secret aircraft mounted on a spine-type pylon that looks like the X-20 Dinosaur, North American Aviation X-20 Dinosaur. But then he said, as they were towing the B-52 through this underground tunnel, there were four other connecting shafts with the main shaft, and he said one of these tunnels was twice as big as the one that he was in, and you could put two B-52s side by side and still have 6 feet on either wingtip. That's what he said. This was in 1992, so you can see how black this world really is.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, indeed. Do you think that the good old Area 51 is part of the development still, both in terms of course, takeoff landing facilities and everything else? How many places do you think they have in the U.S. at this point?
Well, certainly Area 51 is one of them. Edwards North Base Complex is another one. There's a facility in Utah that's very black. We also have Tonopah Test Range, which is also in Nevada. That's a very interesting place. But then there's a incipient place near Tampa, MacDill Air Force Base. They're also doing things there as well. So there's at least five or six pretty somewhat known black aircraft staging areas, but there could be many more within the black world.
Do you think it's a world program? Is it not only the U.S. military, but it might be an international conglomerate?
That's certainly a possibility. I can't comment on that because I don't know for sure. But if it is a worldwide program, I definitely believe the United States is taking the lead.
Yeah, bring it into the fold as well because of just what you mentioned before with the Belgian UFO, the triangle flap back in the, was it late or early 90s or mid 90s maybe, I forget. But I mean, that was very interesting. And the fact is that there's been many places around the world that talk about this. There's certain facilities in Australia as well, of course, Pine Gap, etc. There's a number of these around the world, and it might be something that is connected since this would go far and wide. But is there anything more you want to say about the propulsion? Yeah, please go ahead.
Yeah, there's one more thing I want to say. Is you'll recall that back in 1998, the CIA themselves admitted that during some of the initial U-2 flights and SR-71 flights over Groom Lake, that they encouraged UFO reports as a way to cover their own deep black program aerospace test flights. This is from the CIA. They admitted it themselves. So you can see they already want you to think that these are alien vehicles.
Exactly. That's kind of what I was questioning a little bit earlier there. It seems like there is a mythology on top of all of that where there is a convenience of trying to blame this away on extraterrestrials as opposed to human activities, and therefore, ergo, potentially you could use a build-up of sorts of future support for the program if this can go far enough, right? There are some people that have warned about this and talked about this as well, that this would be exacerbated at some stage perhaps, and this would really kind of kick up the budget and funding for programs like this, right?
Absolutely. Just, I think it's important to never forget that the CIA's mandate is to deny, lie, and deceive. That's their mandate. Is to deny, lie, and deceive. So whatever you see out there, they're going to lie about it. They're going to deceive everyone. They're going to deny its existence. That's their mandate. That's what we're up against. That's what we're fighting. So, you know, my point is that never underestimate what billions, perhaps trillions of black budget funding can do when you have an unlimited budget. You've got a secret airbase 100 miles from Las Vegas, where no one goes to, really. Honestly, no one really goes there. And if they do, you can't go anywhere anyway. Peekaboo Peak is nearly impossible to get to. Very few people even go there. It's a very remote location. You've got engineers who've worked on these things, flown in from McCarran and all around the Southwest area, who are sworn to secrecy. You know they're going to get something for that money. You know that they're going to be building something. What has Lockheed Skunk Works been doing the last 30 years? They've got thousands of people who work at the Skunk Works. What have they been building the last 30 years? This is something that my good friend Jim Goodall asked, something we should all be asking. So my point is never underestimate what the billions in black budgets can do. And before we jump on the extraterrestrial bandwagon, we have to vet out every possible man-made answer to the question before we jump and conclude that something is extraterrestrial. That's all I'm saying.
Sure. Yeah, I definitely agree with that. The question, again, I think I posed this to another upcoming speaker here at the Secret Space program as well. And the question is, can a budget give you everything, though? You still need not only the ideas and the creativity, of course, the expertise, as you just mentioned, that certainly might be there. Could there be inspiration that actually come from somewhere else in terms of actually successfully managed to engineer some of the propulsion systems that are speculated to exist? Or if you throw, you know, endless amount of money on something, it's going to work out eventually.
Okay. Well, what I'd like to do to answer that is I want to give you some of the quotes by Ben Rich. And this is talked about before. We don't have time to go into all of them, but I just want to highlight some of the things here. Now, for those who don't remember, Ben Rich was the head of Lockheed Skunk Works between 1975 and 1991. He was Kelly Johnson's replacement at the Burbank Skunk Works. So this is 75 to 91. He died in 95, but before he passed away, he gave a number of lectures around the country and made some very significant bombshell statements that I've really tried to focus in on and kind of put them all in one group. Now, I will say up front, truth be told, some of these statements, according to other Skunk Works engineers, they believe that these statements are just to increase the mystique of the Skunk Works and kind of garner additional support for the morale of Burbank Skunk Works engineers. That may be the case. I have to say that up front. So maybe we're reading too much into this. Maybe the UFO community is just reading too much into this, and that may be the fact. But maybe not. Maybe Ben really was trying to tell us something before he passed away. So I'm going to leave that for the audience discretion. But let me just review some of the things that were said by Ben Rich. This is not me. This is Ben Rich. Quote, we did the F-104, the C-130, U-2, SR-71, F-117, and many other programs that I can't talk about. We are still working very hard. I just can't tell you what we're doing. This is Wright-Patterson Air Force Base slide presentation, September 22, 1992. Now, in the same presentation, he said, quote, the Air Force has just given us a contract to take ET back home. So, is this just a tongue-in-cheek joke by Ben, or was he trying to tell us something that they already had the technology and the means and the propulsion systems to bring ET back home from the budgets that we've been paying for? I don't know. It's Ben's statement. It's not mine. So we have to leave it at that.
Right.
Next one. We already have the means to travel among the stars, but these technologies are locked up in black projects, and it will take an act of God to ever get to benefit humanity. This was confirmed by Tom Keller and Jan Harzan at the UCLA Alumni Club 32393. So if you think about what he means there, they've already got the technology. They already know how to get to the stars. Tom Keller personally said that Ben Ricks stated that they hire and employ legions of theoretical mathematicians at the Skunk Works figuring out the keys to space travel. Interesting that an aircraft aerospace company would be hiring these theoretical mathematicians to work out their projects. I just thought that was interesting.
Yeah, exactly.
Next one, we now know how to travel to the stars, end quote. Another one, quote, there is an error in the equations and we have figured it out and now know how to travel to the stars and it won't take a lifetime to do it. That's interesting because according to Einstein, once you exceed the speed of light, your mass goes in infinity and it's impossible. You can't travel faster than the speed of light. That's not true according to what Ben Rich said. They already figured it out. So it's a done deal. That means that the star travel, the extrasolar travel between ours and other solar systems might be a possibility. We'll do two more. This is 3393 Ben Rich, quote, it is time to end all secrecy on this as it no longer poses a national security threat and make the technology available for use in the private sector. I mean, I concur. It is time to get these things declassified, but what have we seen since Ben Rich passed away? We've not seen a decrease in black programs, but since 9/11 and under the Obama administration, we've been seeing nothing but more increases in security, more red stamps, more tyrannical dictatorship. We've seen the exact opposite. The last one here, Jim Goodall, a good friend of mine, is the last person to essentially speak to Ben Rich alive before he passed away in 95. He got in a phone call to Ben and actually asked Ben if he'd be interested in doing a non-holds-barred interview and, you know, telling us what he knew and some of the programs within the Skunk Works. And Ben Rich agreed to this. Repeat, Ben Rich agreed to do a non-holds-barred interview with Jim Goodall, where he would essentially tell all or what he could. Unfortunately, That interview never took place because Ben passed away, but Jim Goodall was successful in getting in one more phone call to Ben Rich at the hospital. And this is what Ben Rich told Jim, quote, "Jim, we have things out there in the desert that are 50 years beyond what you could possibly comprehend. If you've seen it on Star Wars or Star Trek, we've been there, done that, or decided it wasn't worth the effort." Ben Rich. So coming from Ben, "We have technologies that are 50 years beyond what we could even comprehend." That's how deep black this really goes.
Exactly. Well, let's pick that up a little bit after the break here and talk more about some of the things that they actually might be doing out there, how far they actually this has gone and everything else. It's very interesting. Why don't we just mention a little bit more about the conference here? Obviously, this is the main topic that you were going to talk more about at the conference, Michael. And so we'll dive into that. And I guess you have a lot of illustrations and photos and everything else, eyewitness testimony illustrations, I guess, right, as well, that you're going to be showing to kind of go along with some of this information, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
All right. Really good. Let's give out some of the websites for that, by the way. Secretspaceprogram.org. That's the main website where you can pick up tickets and everything else, read more about the speakers and everything. And it's June 28th and 29th that this conference is going to take place. And this is in San Mateo, for you guys who do not know. And, I just also want to mention that Red Ice is not organizing this particular event. I've been asked to host the conference. So if you do have any other questions, please direct them towards the good folks over at secretspaceprogram.org through the contact email that you have right there on the website. That's where you also, of course, can pick up tickets and find out everything else about the conference. You can also find the link from redeyesecretions.com. And for our members, we have a discount coupon code available for you guys and gals at redeyesmembers.com. Click the banner either on the page for the program that you're listening to right now. You also have the banner in the Members Radio Archive. So go there for more info, ticket discounts, and where to go to order the tickets. Michael, let's also talk about your book here a little bit. Maybe you can give out the details of where people can pick up a copy of Retrievals of the Third Kind.
Sure. I'll be glad to tell you about it. Most of your researchers may know a very well-known crash retrieval expert known as Leonard Stringfield. He passed away, and then his files, documents, drawings, blueprints were sealed by his widow, Belle Stringfield, for the past 20 years. And she's not allowed access to anyone on this planet at any time, at any cost. It's not for sale. She's been restrictive to everyone seeing this. And everyone from QFOS to MUFON, some people from APRO, different deep-pocketed individuals have tried to buy the collection. She said no to everyone for the past 20 years. It's a tragedy within the field of ufology because this is just so valuable information. Specifically, it has to do with individuals who have firsthand knowledge of UFO crash retrievals. I'm talking about military pilots, commercial pilots, engineers, people who worked in the Atomic Energy Commission, people who worked on the Blue Group teams who were on crash retrievals, essentially people who had firsthand knowledge of these type operations. And as I mentioned before, all of this has been completely sealed for at least 20 years now. Recently, in 2012, David McDonald announced at the MUFON Symposium that a portion of those documents in the form of 86 three-ring binders, dictation notes, were donated to MUFON. So I thought, this is fantastic. This is a bombshell. We're finally going to get to see some of this material. So I immediately put in my request, and I thought, wow, I guess I'm number 127 in line, right? Because there's got to be people all around the world are going to want to see this information. It's the hottest material in ufology, period, bar none. Well, currently, things worked out. I submitted my application. It had to go through the MUFON review board. They accepted my request in March of 2013. I was granted access to all 83 binders. I copied the material, and then my agreement was that if I could be given access to the materials, then I would write a weekly status report, a full-blown AutoCAD drawing, and 3D full-color illustration to essentially vet out the historical accounts of these cases within the Leonard Springfield files. And that's how I was given access to the files. From that, I put together a brand new book, which is called Retrievals of the Third Kind, a reexamination of Leonard Springfield's crash retrieval cases, which is now available on the MUFON website.
Very interesting. Maybe we can talk a little bit more about that on the other side of this break there. But MUFON.com is a website for that, of course, where you can pick up copies of that book. We'll have that linked up as well, so you can find it easily from our website. All right, stay with us, Michael. We'll take a short break here, and then we'll be right back with more after the break. Hour 2 with Michael Schratt is coming up. We just want to let you know, our members specifically, Red Eyes members, that we'll be offering a discount for you guys and gals who want to attend the Secret Space Program Conference. Go to redeyesmembers.com and click on the banner for the conference, and you'll get your discount coupon code there and more information and links on where to go to buy the tickets. We will also be offering a one-month Red Eyes membership for free to those who buy tickets to the conference. As a little teaser for you guys as well, it will be enabled about 2 weeks before the conference starts, so just keep that in mind. So if you want to join us in San Mateo, and if you want to join us in the member section, you can have it both ways. All right, we'll continue to discuss the saucer technology and the accompanying issues to this. We discussed a bit more about Leonard Stringfield and the retrievals of the third kind. We are also going to get into what they are doing out there. We'll discuss some alternative propulsion systems that has been developed, and what some of the insiders claim that they have been working on. Of course, very dodgy and fuzzy territory, but we'll discuss it nonetheless. We have upcoming on the program as well, Andrei Znamensky on the dark side of Tibetan Buddhism. That's going to be an interesting show. We have Mark McClandish, Petter Amundsen, Asharia S., a.k.a. DM Murdoch, and many more exciting guests. All right, everyone, we'll be right back. RedEyesMembers.com is the website. Thank you for listening.